You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Being here today. I'm so thrilled to see each and every one here because I'm a big fan.
Oh,
I'm sitting here with Carrie Butler and Nell Benjamin and Tanya Pinkins, and we're at Sardi's Restaurant in the heart of the Theater District. My favorite place, almost, yeah, pretty much up there. You know, they don't have opening nights here as much anymore.
No.
I mean, I've had a lot of celebrations here. It's like my life flashes before me, really, when I come here, but that's okay. So that's why I want to bring it back here. And here we are. And look at you.
Oh, yeah.
I know.
They've given us a set. Isn't this adorable? They've lifted the, put
adorable.
Us on the stage.
Mm-hmm,
Another
mm-hmm.
element I just want to share with you before we jump in is this table was Vincent Sardi's family table.
Mm. Oh.
And they use it really, really for just. And the first show, they didn't have a cover, and it was kind of like a work of art with all the
doodlings and sketches.
Oh yeah, and then I think Max came in and said, "We want to have a really nice restaurant look." So,
nice.
Anyway, Carrie Butler.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, I had to take notes as I said because. I mean, every time I know that you're in a show, I have to see it because you are so wonderful.
Oh, my goodness.
You
thank
are.
You.
No, I mean, and I'm a big fan because right now you're in Beetlejuice.
Yes.
And I was there, I think it was just before it opened.
Oh.
And how was that tech?
How oh, my gosh.
How did you do that?
Well, the tech actually was very smooth, but there is a lot of magic, and
so
it's scary.
So much going
not gonna
on.
Lie to you.
But you know,
the first 15
did
minutes.
You see that the show yet?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my God! And you know, this was an early audience, but there were people that had been there many times already.
The audience dresses up.
Yes,
they go
yes.
bananas like every night, so it's fun.
So. And meeting you yesterday for the first time was a thrill in a special way because of your podcast, too.
Oh, yes, I just started.
Yeah, what is the name of that?
It's called Breaking Broadway, and it's really because I get asked on my Instagram every day, how do I make it in the business? What do I do? So it's fun. I'm just interviewing people like casting directors and agents and really from a grounds up so people who don't live anywhere near the city will know how to find out about auditions, how
right.
we need it.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay, so I'm just going to, what we've got Blood Brothers. Was that your first?
That was my
first
Broadway show, yeah.
And then 2 years of Beauty and the Beast. You went from that to Les Mis and Bat Boy, which I'm really sorry I missed seeing that.
Oh, yeah, it was great.
And
Bat
I remember,
Boy like Bat Boy from Weekly World News.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes. Nell's
the
husband
best show.
Wrote
That's
it.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you
Ooh,
meet
husband
the,
wrote, my
that,
husband
did
Lawrence
you write the
article
Keith.
From Bat
no,
Boy?
No, they. But two people he was working with at the Actors Gang saw this article. Were like, there should be a play about him, and maybe we should have some music. And Larry said, no, there should be a musical about him. So they developed it all together. And Carrie was
very
wow.
amazing.
That's
a great show.
Yeah,
I just started
show.
Writing for Weekly.
And then I saw Xanadu.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God! And you learned how to skate in that show.
I did.
Wait, you didn't already know how to skate?
No. When they called up. They were like, can you roller skate? And my husband was listening. I was like, yeah, I can roller skate.
Oh.
And I asked him, he's like, honey, did you just tell them you could roller skate? And I was like, yeah, when I was 9, I used to go to roller skating birthday parties. And so then I had to do all kinds of tricks. And it was, yeah, every day I was nervous I was going to break a leg. But
it was such a good
show. I made
show.
It.
That
was great. Yes. Three people did break legs before we opened.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
So how did you wish people good luck?
Exactly.
Yeah. But you know that that show it was fantastic. And how long did that last?
I feel like maybe a year.
Yeah. Rock of Ages I missed. Now that how was that experience? That was like a
It was fun in that like I was getting to live out my rock and roll dreams, right. You know, like I got to perform all these fun 80s songs and sing, but at the same time, I was playing a stripper and like it felt like I was a stripper, so it was a little demoralizing by the end. I was like, oh my gosh,
get me out of this
I really
costume.
Got into the character.
Yeah, because you're a great actress. I just have to say actor now. I have to be politically, no. That's your show, right? Politically correct?
You can't say that. The show where you can.
Yeah. but you are, because then when I said, well let's see, Catch Me If You Can, all these awards, the Drama Desk Awards, and The Call was the first play?
It wasn't the first. The Best Man was the first one that I had to do with Angela Lansbury
oh, wow.
and James Earl Jones. But The Call was very close to my heart because that was at Playwrights Horizons, and it was about a family who adopts from Africa, and I adopted my daughters from Africa.
Wow.
So it was very personal.
At the same time, that was...
I had already adopted my daughters,
right.
And I went in for the audition, and I was like, yeah, I know this.
Yes, yes.
But I still had to go through, you know, I had to go on callbacks and things like that, but I ended up getting it.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And Under My Skin, mm-hmm.
I was off Broadway.
Right.
Yes, fun.
And Disaster, I was able to see that, and then flipped for Mean Girls.
Oh, yeah.
That was fantastic.
Thank you.
And I didn't even know it was you, and I was, following you, you know, and then I went, is that Carrie? Who's that?
Aww.
It was great. The way That's you big. Defined, this is the you know, the way you defined the characters.
Oh, thank you.
And you're so funny.
Thanks.
But it's the acting. It starts with the acting, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
So, and I have this, like, Oklahoma in Europe. Was that your first professional?
That was my first professional job. Yeah, we did the whole show in English. And then we did the finale in German. So it was so, we like, oh, Oklahoma, Dinofelde, Wiegand, Zickenwind.
We just learned it.
We just learned it in the different languages that we went to. So I learned it in Italian and German. Like, think about it. Oh, Kappa, Ella, Ab. Like, you had to know.
No, does it fit? Like,
no,
how does it
doesn't
stand?
Fit.
As a lyricist, this is intriguing.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Back up. You had to learn languages in
for you had to learn the song Oklahoma
in the different
language
of the country that we went to.
I see. That's really.
So everything else was in English, which wasn't great for comedy when you're in Germany and doing Oklahoma.
Right.
But it was a fantastic experience.
Right. Yes.
Crazy.
You know, they're doing a Chorus Line in Spain, Antonio Banderas. I keep mentioning it because I'm so madly in love with him. And what he's doing, and he has given a theater to his birth town, Malaga, and they're opening next month, and he's going to play Zach. And he's so smart. He's doing the same thing, but in reverse. They're doing the whole show in Spanish.
Oh.
And then the finale... and it was his idea, one, is in English, because he said everyone will know. And it scans better.
And it scans better, yeah.
Than Uno, I guess.
Yeah, the translations are tricky. Actually, I have a funny translation story that someone told, I think Rusty Mowry told me, and it's about Hairspray, that when they were translating Hairspray into German, there's a line where Velma von Tussle, who thinks she's defeated Tracy, says, you know, you're not getting on the show or whatever. Game, set, match.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently the translators told them, we don't say that. I was like, you don't say game, set. I wasn't me, but someone said, you don't say game, set, match. And they're like, no, but we have something else that we can put there. So they put this phrase there that means, like, game over, but literally translates as cage closed, monkey dead. And I just want to make it a thing. I want to make it a thing in English, too.
Cage closed, monkey dead.
That's so funny.
Ooh. And when we had Legally Blonde translated into German, we asked those translators, I was like, is this story true? And they're like, yeah, it's true. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And they knew the phrase.
I don't even want to ask about that reference.
Cage closed, monkey dead.
Yeah.
Was the cage closed first? Like, I don't know if the monkey was dead already or the cage closed somehow. It raises so many questions.
Yes.
As a good lyric should.
Another way that theater brings us together.
Yes.
So I found this, and I think you know it, but it's the way I feel, and I would just, and I love the fact that it was a Times reviewer that said this about you. Miss Butler is the rare Broadway ingenue who is as funny as she is pretty, and she sings gloriously too. Charles Isherwood.
Well,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. And I missed Hairspray. I'm
glad you didn't read one of the bad ones.
We've all had them, but yeah. I can't imagine you having a bad review. It's you're too good. Even in Hairspray, which I also, I think that was the first time I saw you.
Maybe, yes,
and
probably.
And that character was so, for a young, I mean, you were young. That, I mean, you're young now, but you were really young. Was that, that...
I was the oldest one out of the cast, but yeah, it was amazing.
So,
it was so fun.
Unique, so yeah. Unique and a great.
I loved it. Great. It was really fun.
So, Nell, I said it before, but congratulations on Halftime. I was thrilled to. I love that score.
I know.
And one of the highlights for me of that year, of if more than a year, certainly. Even now, people are calling me because they love the score so much before I even heard it, you know.
Yeah, it was wonderful to work
and with. And to work with you and Matthew Sklar, who, the composer, on that new song and mix things up and change. I mean, it was like, that's my favorite part, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, being in the room, creating, finding that process that it's hard to find anymore, you know, the time, the luxury of time that we... We used to have, right? Mm. So yes. So I have to refer to my notes. I didn't know. Well, you're a composer as well, lyricist and a playwright.
Lyricist, librettist.
Right.
You're a playwright. Librettist is like fancy for book writer.
So these are just little. So Legally Blonde, but that's what you did with Lawrence O'Keefe, your husband.
I did. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And. Tony, Best Original Score, nomination.
Nomination, yeah.
And then Mean Girls, where you, nomination, Best Lyrics. Because of Winn-Dixie, I've heard so much about this.
Yeah, we just did it up at Good Speed.
Right.
It was a beautiful production. It's a very sweet, it's a great book if you don't know the book.
Yeah.
So it's essentially about
it. Is it going to...
I don't know where, things are going, but we were really pleased to have the show we had up there, and it's generated a lot of excitement, so hopefully, someone will see it at some point.
And then, well, all these shows that I've heard about, but I wasn't privy to be there at the time, Dave in Washington,
was that the arena stage?
That was arena,
yeah, that was really fun.
Yeah, and the Explorers Club.
Explorers Club at Manhattan Theater Club.
I loved that.
Thank you.
I love that.
That was fun. That was just like letting your id go out there and
make a
show for you.
Where did you get that? Where did that come? How did that come to you?
Because
I love the subject of it. You know.
So the original inspiration was a friend of mine who's a rather brilliant scientist who had a lot of struggles being treated as a scientist because she was female. And so she would tell me these crazy stories and, so that was kind of the idea, but
the old boys club,
kind of thing. So I thought if we had a literal old boys club, that would be fun. And I've always been a fan of like these crazy explorers clubs and, the idea of these sort of, this period where, science was mostly sort of cheerful, rich dilettantes who would go out and be like, I found this guy.
And raid the tombs.
Yes, exactly, and do all this sort of stuff. And they were, sort of lurching towards a scientific reason, but so blinkered by their own prejudices in a lot of cases and just upbringing and stuff like that. And which, of course, we all still are, when you do something like science. But so I just thought it would be really, really super fun and... in a play that had like a bar smack in the center that was very much about cocktail culture was also very interesting. I just wanted to
And that year, 1879, before the turn of the century, which is...
I believe it's 73, I think. I'd have to list. I don't remember offhand. But it was nerdy and fun in every possible way for me. It was like my steampunk nerdiness. There was also just a bunch of incredible stories about women who go into... the sciences. There was a very, the name is going to fly right out of my head as I tell you the story, but there was a woman who was a very accomplished mathematician and astronomer, and she wanted to use a telescope in Italy that was in a monastery. So she petitioned the Vatican so that she could use their telescope. And they, you know, they said an unaccompanied female with all these men around, and they said, well, you can use the telescope, but only during the day. Mm. Which, for those people who do astronomy, which is utterly useless. So they were so concerned about her virtue and the virtue of the monks who presumably...
Was it really the virtue of
her? Exactly. When we think about the scandals we're going with now, she wasn't really
right,
in
she wasn't even, yeah. Well, you know, but the, I guess the idea of the impropriety of this lone woman being surrounded by men.
Yeah, but this is what I love about, even in Mean Girls when it came through, you know, you empower women and girls. I mean, it's a great thing because it's an entertainment, you know, you serve it up, but then the message is there. And so it's like, when you think of that, I would love to see the day when the empowering is there, and then there's no threat. Do you know what I mean? When we're the threat of what is the threat of a woman doing what women want to do? Where is the threat? It's power game, you know?
Yeah, well, we have to build a community of women who are comfortable being powerful and other women who are comfortable being around powerful women.
Yes. Yeah.
So
true.
It's like building that community of powerful women enjoying that.
So it's not just the men not wanting to keep the place.
Yeah, I've been thinking a very long time about why we as women surrender our power sort of voluntarily. We are animals, and in nature there are just so many species where a male would not think of approaching a female in any way. They would get killed, they would get eaten.
Yeah.
But somehow we as human females have dismantled that particular self-preservation instinct in order to catch a man, I guess, because in nature we would be like, hop, don't you dare come near us, and we just...
Especially those mothers, right?
Right. Instead, we're looking for legislation to protect us, and it's like asking the fox to protect us? Like, that doesn't make sense to me.
There's
So how did she solve... Was the problem solved? Did she...
What, my friend?
Yeah.
Oh, she just... She did her work, and she's a brilliant genius, a doctor of physics, astrophysics. And,
wow.
And she's launched satellites for ESA and
that's
things like
the,
that.
That's the key. Just keep doing the work, right?
But then also there's other things that come up like kids and family and, how does that... That's obviously not something we explored in Explorers Club, but that does change what you're able to do, how you're able to do it, unless you're lucky enough to work with powerful women who say, nope, that's part of it. And I'm going to, if you're going out of town with a show, I'll find you an extra room for your kids to be with you. And I will make allowances for the fact that the first week of school you can't have rehearsal because you'll be involved with
exactly.
That.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
You know, these things can be worked out. And it's so interesting that what I'm learning when I meet, thank you very much. Really good last time, too. It's like we were talking to Beth Level, and she took time out to have her two kids, I believe, and lived with that threat of I might not be able to get back or backtracking or I'm going to miss out or whatever that great opportunity is, and she came back just fine. If you live long enough, I think you find that you can. And you had
I listened to
and some of the things you were talking about when your acting teacher said don't have
my acting teacher Bill Esper.
He was great in every other way, but
well,
it's
he was
like,
great even in that. Yeah. He was honest, and it was absolutely true. I was pregnant with my first son during the class, and I birthed him and came back and would carry him around in my little fanny pack while I was doing the object exercises. He like grew up in Bill's acting class, and then he grew up and took Bill's acting class. And
had Bill already had a career at that point? Or was this just a
career? I'd been on soap operas
stuff
like that. So I'd been working professionally since I was like 12. And he just said, you know, if you have these, he said, don't have any more. He said, because it takes time to raise a child. And he said, everyone who is coming up with you, they will have progressed in their careers beyond you, and you just will never catch up. And that is absolutely true.
Uh-huh.
But I don't regret having my children.
No.
So I did the jobs that I was supposed to do. And for me, a life has always been more important than a career, because a career is not a life.
Yeah.
Right.
And it cannot sustain you.
Yes.
But also, as an artist, everything you are, you can only act so much, you know. Mm-hmm. Everything you are reflects in what you do.
Yes.
And there's, I had to take a break. I mean, it was forced, but when I got really ill, but it was all about not giving myself a chance to be, you know, to enjoy myself mm-hmm. enough, and my body just stopped. But I think what you're saying is true. But when you do step back and gather your resources, and then come back to the fold, there's so many opportunities. And now at my age, my gosh. I had no idea I would be working into my 70s.
Yes.
But I'm glad for it.
It's amazing.
But you have to also, you have to keep creating the demand too, you know? Mm-hmm. But a life is very important. I mean, to balance, to be able to balance that out, and I was never good at, I was always struggling to survive. But anyway, enough about me, as they say.
What do you think about me?
Yeah. I just want to cover just a couple things with Nell, because I wish I had seen this too, and this might be still touring. Sarah Plain and Tall. That you?
Oh, thank you. No, that is not still running.
Okay, but that got such good response. And
Dallas Theater Center, and we did that with TheaterWorks USA, which was one of the first. Places to actually hire me to do anything, so I'm very fond of TheaterWorks USA.
Oh, ta-da! edit. Sorry.
That's all right.
Bon appetit, everyone.
Oh, yeah,
bon appetit.
Yeah,
you too. These are interesting facts that they were really interesting. That yeah. You've got all these wonderful, like the Kleban Foundation Award and the
Kleban is a very strong reason why I do what I do, because I was lucky enough to win the Kleban, which was both enough money to live and finish Sarah, among other shows that I was working on, and do a great deal of work on Explorers Club way back when, but also this affirmation mm-hmm. that
yes.
said, someone thinks what you do is good.
Yes.
That was huge. I'm very grateful to the Kleban and to Ed Kleban for setting it up in the first place many years ago. So yeah,
no. He was a great person and a great lyricist.
I didn't know him, but
I loved him so much, and he was the unsung hero, I think, for A Chorus Line.
Oh, his lyrics on that are astonishing.
So, and then there was the Jonathan Larson Grant
Award, and, you know, likewise. Yeah,
I love the support that you can get, because people think that. When they see us in our, you know, finery and our presentation and our performances that are well rehearsed, they think that life is just great and mm-hmm. we live a carefree life.
Yes, glamorous.
And it's, you know, it's just easy, you mm-hmm. know. So we know that's not true, but
and they want to think that. Because it's an escape from their own lives.
Right.
They want to think that there's some other place that one day they could go and it mm-hmm. would be different.
But one of the things I love about sharing the ups and downs, you know, that we all have, we all go through it, I think. Mm-hmm. But it's wonderful, it's encouraging and inspiring for someone like a younger generation, or, you know, women who are struggling with aging, you know, and they want to keep singing, and they got it. Everything changes. I have a new voice teacher. Because your cords get thicker, everything, your body
really?
Changes.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Well, I can still sing a high C, but, you know.
Did you get a lower voice?
What?
Did you get a lower voice?
I did.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Yeah. But
I'm
that's
like
part
almost
of,
a baritone.
That's great. But, I mean.
As a non-performer, it's so, vocal talk is so interesting to me.
Really?
No, it really is, because we write musicals, and you just write what you write. And then if it tortures someone, that's not your problem. No, it's true. This is the general thought. And I think there's also been a trend towards much more difficult scores, particularly for women. So for me, trying to learn a little bit about how people take care of their voices and what they can and can't do becomes kind of important, because, sure, I can write you this fabulous song, but unless you're Cary Butler, like, it can wreck your voice within a month, you know, and that's not what you want.
The interesting thing, my teacher, Derek Rosenblatt, also works
with... He was in my building.
And he works with Alex Brightman.
Yes, a lot of people.
But he was, you know, and I went to him because I said, I started it, you know, I had a light soprano, and I was one of those belters that worked with Ethel Merman and with before microphones.
Wow.
So I was just, it was all that big sound and high, you know. But I went to him and I said, look, I want to be able to keep singing, But I want to be able to blend that, you know, that passage. I want to be able to make it that one voice. Mm-hmm. And so the transition isn't rough, that it goes right up in its place and is, you know, mm-hmm. reflects and everything. Anyway, sorry for all the...
No, that's what I said. This is interesting to me.
And because I wanted to be able not to sing Mean Girls, but, you know, I couldn't do it anyway. But to be able to keep singing, you know, mm-hmm. just to be able to keep... doing because I love it so much.
Yeah.
But he worked with Alex Brightman, and I said, "How?" When he was in the other show, the Rock
School of Rock,
I saw him, and I went, "How does he do that 8 times a week?" I said, "He can't do that. I mean, he should have a career. He shouldn't be. Right. This shouldn't be his last show." Mm. And he worked out. Did you know this, that they filmed?
To make sure he's singing healthy.
He has an extra
healthy.
What?
They filmed, how did, you can help
you know,
me
they
with
scoped
this.
Him.
Right.
For insurance purposes, right? too, you know, because in Beetlejuice, he does this raspy voice the whole time. So if the whole show is on his shoulders and he's out then.
Right.
So they scoped him doing the voice, and he doesn't have an extra fold. He's a flap that most people don't know how to work.
It's not
and he
on the
can
cords.
Control, he doesn't hurt at all.
Right. It's not, it's like, it's right here. It's not on the cords. It's not around the cords. It's like right here. And he has learned or he's
adapted. Yes, and he trained himself, to do it.
So he can feel it.
So when.
I guess he can control it.
So when you see in the film, and I saw it at Derek's.
Oh.
When you see the film, you see a natural sound where you see the chords approximating.
But you saw the film of his.
Yeah.
Of the scope. Of the scope.
No, this is astonishing.
This is not talking. I thought it was phenomenal because I was really concerned about him because he's such a great performer.
This is fascinating too because, like, you know, have you ever heard Layla Hathaway who can sing two notes simultaneously? She can.
No.
She can harmonize with her.
What are
she
those?
Can
two
hit two chords. She can hit two. She can harmonize.
That's
with herself.
A cultural thing.
And I
something.
Wonder if that she has something like that because it's amazing when you hear her hitting two notes at the same time.
Well, I actually saw when he was using these muscles and when he wasn't, when it was just the chords approximate his normal voice.
And he
voice.
Can choose to do that.
And
there's a
certain thing, it's like when you have to growl or scream, mm-hmm. like when you have to scream in the script.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I finally learned how to do it. I was losing my voice when I did Dark Shadows. Yeah. I had to scream all the time. Mm-hmm. And you have to, and Larry Blank taught me, you know, the music mm-hmm. director, that you have to scream on pitch.
Yeah.
If you
like
go
you're
for
singing.
If you go for a pitch, then you can scream, hit your
and get your tongue out of the way.
Hit.
Get your tongue out of the way.
You know, like,
right.
Instinct, when you're scared, you will pull your tongue back.
Okay.
But so you go, kind of.
Ah!
Yeah.
I don't know if my tongue was out of the way, but I was trying
it
to
did.
Think
it
of
it.
It's
a
projection.
Yes.
I feel like if you're in a dangerous situation, that's a better way to scream than the scared way to scream. Because that would actually, I'd be like, I'm not mugging you.
Well, you have the power. You have a voice. Okay. I can't wait to get to it. But I just want to cover, so when you went to, I have to have one bite of my crab cake. When you went to... After you were here, you went to Harvard and you met your husband at Harvard, and then you went to, you went to
I
California?
Went to college, and I met him there in college.
And then you guys then, went to California and wrote for television for
well, we
a decade?
Were, so we both went, I did not write for, I wish I'd written for television for a decade. No, I went to California. He was there working with the Actors Gang. He was actually working in theater, but he also did USC Film Scoring School. And I worked here for a while, and I did graduate school here, and then decided what with college costing what it costs and things like that, I did not think I would be able to make a living writing. So I loved to do it, but I didn't think I'd be able to do it. So I went into banking.
Ooh.
And and I did that for a while, and I did grad school, and then I did banking.
Wow.
And it was incredibly interesting, and I met very fascinating people, and they loved what they did. They really loved it. They could watch the markets. I worked on a trading floor, which was super exciting, with brilliant people, and they just would love it. And I did not love it. And so I thought, well, I could do well in this. But it's not what I love.
Numbers, that's a whole other part of the, that's a separate part of the brain, I think, because I don't,
I love
I certainly
numbers.
Don't
oh, I think
it.
Numbers are very similar to music.
Is
yes.
it?
And
mm-hmm.
language and
really?
Stuff. Yeah. I don't think it's that different.
Yeah.
But it's more like, you know, I don't know, it's just if you love the problems of how do I say, you know, hedge my risk, or you know, where do I think this is going to go, or how do I think this is going to work, then you love that problem, and you love that game. And if you love the problem of how do I say this in a certain way, that's a different game, and one that I like better.
I like the way you put that, love the problem, because I try to tell my kids all the time that life is just learning how to solve problems. And if you want to have a really big life, you have to be willing to accept some really big problems.
Yeah, that's a great thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to me, the harder it is to solve, the more fun it is to work on. Mm-hmm. So when people say, you know, oh, you should do this as a musical, my first thought is, can I see it as a musical already? Is it easy? And if it's easy, I'm less tempted.
Yeah.
When someone pitches me the weirdest idea
that's
ever,
right.
And you're like, that's what I want.
I've got one for you.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Because of the challenge, too. And it's like sometimes I go, what am I going to be able to give this, and what is it going to give me? What is it? The fear, it's like I've always been most successful when I've walked into the fear.
Me, too.
Walked forward.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
And I'm terrified a lot of the time.
Yes.
But it's like, I don't know. It's like a modus operandi at this point. You know, I don't know how else to do it. Otherwise, I'm not interested.
Agreed.
I get bored or something.
If there's no challenge, something that I can fail at, I'm not interested in the job.
And we want to get better, too, don't we?
Yeah.
I have to, you know, Tina Fey, I'm going to be jumping all over because I can't wait.
Jump away.
I'm already in Jelly's Last Jam in my head. But how was that? That you've worked with so many different composer writers.
Mm-hmm.
That's a challenge, isn't it? How do you?
Well, it depends with my
style
husband,
of working.
It's easy because he's a genius and it's fantastic. The only downside of working with your husband is you can't come home at night and complain about the idiots at work. But he is. So that's, you know, we already have a shorthand and we have the same sense of humor.
You wrote about, you know, you start, because I'm curious about the words come first, the music, everybody's a little different.
Everybody's different, yeah.
But you start with part of the words, like the first.
I start, yes. I mean, for us, and in most situations actually, I start with the moment. Because what is the moment here where a song will take a character from point A to point B to point C, as opposed to a song that will maybe restate an emotion that's already happened, which I don't find so interesting. Mm-hmm. Like,
so you don't want to keep playing the condition?
No, you know, even if you're like, oh, I have a great phrase, or I have a great tune, or I have a great whatever, I kind of feel that for musical theater, unlike for some other kinds of songs like pop or things like that, it's not about sitting necessarily in emotion. It's about watching a character make a decision or do something.
Like a beginning, a middle, and an end, a resolve.
Right, to say I'm feeling this is just step one. But to say I'm feeling this, so what am I going to do about it, is what kind of grips me when I'm watching a song. So the moment where we say, okay, this is a big decision, this should be a song, or this is a moment where they're trying to accomplish this, so that should be a song. And then start throwing words out. And I like to hand a finished lyric to a composer. That's what I like, because I'm a crazy control freak perfectionist. So I like to make sure it's like exactly what...
And you're fast.
That if they did that, it would be... I would be fine with it, like if they didn't touch it. Of course, they never don't touch it, particularly my husband, who then returns it in a way that's made it better, which makes me competitive, and then I do another draft into him. So we're always kind of throwing our A game at each other.
That's
but
nice,
I think,
though.
I think that makes it better.
I'm excited.
And then some things stick and some things you can't.
Some things fall away, or something you think is the most brilliant idea ever, and then the person that you trust most in the room says, I don't even get that joke. And you're like, really? All right. But I've also been lucky, not just in working with Larry. I worked with Jeff Richman on Mean Girls, and he is a brilliant composer.
Yes,
and
he's also Tina Fey's husband.
Yes, yes. And Tina as well, which I can talk more about in a second. But Tom Kitt and Matt Sklar.
Yes,
and
Matt, I'm in love with him.
Oh, he's
too,
wonderful.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, these are
But Tom Kitt, that's a whole different. Was that a different working?
It's always different because they're different people, but these are people steeped in how musicals and music work, and they're the kind of composers that I think are great, which are they have a sense of how, and Duncan Sheik as well, like,
yeah,
how the words are going to sit on the music and what they're going to do for the show, as opposed to sort of handing you a tune and saying, here's the tune.
Right. So
put something
people
there.
Of like mind that they respect the same things.
Yeah. And I feel very comfortable telling them, I find this an interesting idea for a song, or I don't find that an interesting idea for a song, which doesn't mean it's a bad idea for a song. It's just me personally, I'm not going to generate a good lyric because it bores me.
Yeah.
So I actually feel very lucky to have worked with so many different and smart and talented people.
Yeah.
And that's theater. The collaboration is what makes it fun.
Yes,
rather
exactly.
Than kind of going off on your own and writing your memoirs.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's much more fun to be in a room with a bunch of smart, fun people and solve the problem than on your own.
And that is the best, I think. I have to read this quote because this jumped out at me.
Oh dear.
Because it has to do with the Mean Girls, you know, the message that you give to all of your, you know, through all of your work, because you care so much about the, as we all do in our work, the human condition, you know, and the theater that brings us all together. And this is one of the, can't read my own writing, it's very late. One of the roughest things you can do in life is stand up for someone you have no stake with, mm-hmm. and it's the necessary courage to have.
Yeah.
And that I love that. Yeah. That just went...
Well, that's hard. That's what it is, right? It's some, you know, maybe you have the courage to stand up for yourself, but it's when you talk about these bullying situations or situations in school or wherever, or, you know, in life, in our often very unjust world, the hardest thing to do is to have no stake in someone, to actively know that it will actually hurt you to stand up for that person and still have to do something.
Do the right
thing. And I'm not naturally that person. Mm-hmm. I'm in many ways a very deep coward, and I've had to make myself something like that.
Yeah.
Whereas my daughter, and she's amazing to me. She'll like go up to the people on the playground if there's something going on. She's like a full foot shorter than everybody else, and she's like, "He said no. Leave him alone." And I was just like, "Where does that come from?"
Mm. And it came from you.
I wish, but
no, you're but it also, obviously the love and support that
spirit. That's what she brought into the world.
Right. And I also think it's a changing time. I mean, she was raised with Mean Girls, frankly, and these are the messages that we're putting out there. And you know, I don't know that Mean Girls made her brave, but I do think that Tina Fey and her whole being a woman in comedy world, people like her. Are sending the message that, like, we're going to be who we're going to be, and we're going to do it in a way that is decent and kind, and we're going to have comedy that's about making the world better, not comedy that's about sniping at people and bringing them down. We're not going to punch down.
Right.
We're going to punch up.
Right.
I love my punch gestures. I'm sorry.
And I was surprised at this, that she, in an article I read, said that she didn't want to be the only woman in the room at the workplace. Now, I remember hearing stories. I was lucky to work with Nancy Ford and Gretchen Cryer and you and Carolyn Lee. I did some TV with her.
Oh, my gosh.
And Dorothy Fields I never met, but I would hear, I love her lyrics, and I heard stories that she was in the day of the old boys' club. She was the only woman. Mm-hmm. And she had a real challenge with that.
I think there's certainly a generation where just to get one woman in was incredible.
Right, but it's better now.
Yeah,
not much better. I don't think.
No. And we're working on it. But Tina, when she told this, she told it. I remember it very vividly at the Variety Women in the Arts, powerful women. It's one of those women in the title in somewhere. And she told this great story, and because she's funny, she said that I would be the only woman in the room, and when I would try and hire other women, it would be like I asked to get a cappuccino machine. And they'd be like, oh, no, we already have one of those. Like, we don't need two of those.
Oh, my God.
And then they said, and God forbid the cappuccino machine was like a little, didn't work so well. And they'd be like, no, we tried that. Cappuccino machines don't work in this situation. And she's like, I will not be the cappuccino machine. Mm. So that's the chant that when I'm lucky enough to be considered for a project, I'm like, who can I bring in with me?
Yeah.
And that's 100% due, I think, to
hearing that story from Dina, is just understanding, oh, wait, because I never thought, I'm like, it's not my responsibility to make sure other
that's
people.
That's right.
But
that's
it is
right.
my it's responsibility.
Right. Yes.
So
yeah.
that is...
At these times, anyway, yeah. I think. You know, there was, it reminds me of, there was, do you know the Cuban pianist, Alicia de la Roca?
I do not, no.
She was a great, I mean, I remember my psychiatrist telling me this story, because we were talking about some of these issues, and she was a fantastic pianist, and there was this haughty conductor who said, would go around saying, I can always tell when it's a male or female playing. On a recording, because men are just better. And I don't know if he meant in terms of the strong left hand or whatever.
He was just being a misogynist.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. So the whole point of this story and the funny part is that he listened to her recording and he said, that is not a woman. That's, you know, so.
Well, there was a very famous situation that happened with a lot of symphony orchestras now. People audition behind a screen.
Right.
So you can't tell if it's male or female. And since they started doing that, it has upped the number of women in symphony orchestras.
When did that happen?
I don't know. I read it in one of those.
A while ago. It's about 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah, like a Malcolm Gladwell book, like Blink, I think I read about it in.
So, you know, everything we're talking about, I mean, it's... You were so compelling to me to see you on stage when I first saw you, Jelly's Last
Jam. I feel the same way about you.
And everything you are. Oh, thanks.
And I would try to dance in my mirror.
And last night, I had been watching because I had missed, I was out of the country, I think, when you did Caroline or Change. And I was watching all the, and you know what, performances don't always come across on film with that kind of, you know, edge and excitement and everything, but I was so moved by it. I think it was maybe the opening night or you know, Carolina Change. You don't watch those? You don't?
No.
Okay. I understand. I have a hard time with it, but it was so everything I want to be in life. In other words, you know that the power of your conviction, your passion. And then so I was reading about you and watching all these things, and all of a sudden she appears last night at Dory Berenstein's, our wonderful producers, get together for the what is it, Broadway?
Broadway Podcast.
BroadwayPodcast.com. and you appeared, and I almost burst into tears because I had so much, you know, new. Your performance was so fresh with
thank
me.
You.
And Jelly's Last Jam was the first. Now that was not your first show.
No, Merrily We Roll Along was my first Broadway show.
Really?
Yeah. The original one. Yeah.
Wow.
And you're being from Chicago. You did some work with the Goodman Theater. And...
My very first professional play. I was 16. I did Death and the King's Horsemen, the world premiere of Wole Soyinka's play, and Gregory Mosher directed it. And I went to the Kennedy Center in my senior year.
Wow.
And then I booked Merrily We Roll Along when I was 19 over Christmas break of my freshman year at Carnegie Mellon.
Because everybody was young in that production. That was
not really.
Not really.
But that was the press.
That was the press. Okay. The things you learn at lunch.
But then that was kind of going imploding, right? That show, they had to make changes, and it started one way, and as does happen.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I was at my osteopath, the homeopath, the other day, and he was explaining to me the history of those two forms of medicine, and he used this word in a way I'd never been used before, which was that it was clairvoyant. And I was like, oh, that's what I am. I am clairvoyant. And so I remember getting that show, and it wasn't going to start for a year before I went to college, and I didn't ever think that people were like, oh, you're going to be a star, and the show's going to start. And I was like, we'll see. You know, I just, I don't know, I had that kind of feeling. And I always dreamed, those were the two people I most dreamed of in my life to ever work with, Hal Prince and Steve Sondheim.
Oh, wouldn't you?
So to get to do that was amazing. And I think, as weird as it sounds, to watch the two greatest people in the genre fail was the biggest gift I could have ever gotten. Because thereafter, failing just didn't mean that anything. It was like, they're great. And they failed.
Right.
And they'll be great again. Yeah, and so it's like, for me, it's like, if you're not failing, you're not really trying hard enough.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
You're not failing, you're not learning.
That's a great lesson. I to take. I mean, because, yeah, not to have those expectations, too. To focus on what is important, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Your next job was, what was job, was that?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I've done like 9 Broadway shows.
Yeah.
So,
well, let me refer to my
after
notes.
That one, I don't, Merrily, then I don't know.
We have a lot in common.
Jelly,
we have Bikram in common, too. But
Bikram.
Yes, the Caucasian Chalk Circle. Was that the first time you worked with George
no.
C. Wolfe?
I met George C. Wolfe when I was on the soap opera. I think it was on As the World Turns. And a friend of mine, Keisha Bostic, said, you must meet this man. He's so brilliant. And he was in the NYU Musical Theater Program.
Oh, my gosh.
So I met him, and I read what would become The Colored Museum, and it was just the most extraordinary writing I'd ever read, and invited him to write my nightclub act at what was then Sweetwater's on Amsterdam Avenue. And so he wrote this nightclub act for me, and it was fantastic, but what it wasn't to me was it wasn't Colored Museum. These crazy characters mm-hmm. who were prescient, and so I thanked him for making this thing, but I was trying to say, I wish I had some of those crazy characters. And however I explained that to him, he heard it as me attacking his writing. And he didn't come see the show, and he didn't speak to me for the next 7 years, during which he became the George C. Wolfe.
Oh my gosh.
And I couldn't even get an audition for anything he had done.
Oh, my Lord.
So that
but
you
were both
Caucasian
drawn to each
circle.
Other, obviously.
I've worked with him yeah. more than anyone in my career, and there's just nobody more thrilling to work with
yeah.
as an artist. He's also clairvoyant and brilliant and funny, and once you've worked with him, he spoiled you for life.
I just want to work with him so much. I just want to work with
him,
and I hope I do.
You
but
do.
I have to tell you the funny story. When I, when my dear friend Tommy Walsh, we were doing he was directing me in a show that I put together, and this is when George first got to the Public Theater, and I had a meeting set up, and I was really excited but very nervous because I didn't know if I would fit into what he was trying to do there.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, I was right about that. But we get in the office, and you know how those meetings are. It's really hard for me to, you know, to talk about what I'm, what, as, you know, do a, what do they call it? Give a good
pitch.
Meeting. Yeah, yep. Pitch. Not, you know, but I sat there, and Tommy was great with me, and George is sitting there like this, and he goes, you don't remember me, do you? Yeah, and that was my little, that was, I just went, oh my God. I've been in my little ego bubble too long. I've worked with him? No, I haven't worked with him. And I said, gee, George, I don't know. I remind me, and I'm just like falling apart. And he said, I was an apprentice at Williamstown when you were doing Three Penny Opera with Raul Julia.
Mm.
And I went, an apprentice? First of all,
there's so many.
There's so many. And no, I didn't remember him. And he, you know, because they would do everything. They would sleep in a
yeah.
house together. They would paint the sets. They would
yeah.
build the sets. And then they had them as extras. They'd wear mm-hmm. these big monk, you know, brown sacks on their head. And but I thought that, but he had fun with that.
Yeah. But it was like was it a sort of like a pleasant joke to put your ear, or was it a power move to sort of put you not at ease? Is
no, I just think he was having fun
yeah.
with it, you know. No, it wasn't to put me at ease.
No.
I don't think. But I really...
It's sort of funny that in an industry that's dedicated to communication, there are so many miscommunications
yeah.
offstage. It's just very...
But I have such respect for him and admire, you know, what he does.
Yeah,
he's just a great director.
I wouldn't have my career if it weren't for him.
But that's amazing. What I love is that Jelly's Last Jam, which was a phenomenal show with a phenomenal cast, and that was your Tony Award-winning mm-hmm. performance, and... The what you went through, it's like you've talked about it before, but to have that, was that a fear, you know, she kept everything kind of like close to the chest, you know, your rehearsals, and when you finally...
Well, it's a little...
You were being protective, or...
No, I hadn't, as I said, George and I had gone like 7 years of not communicating.
Right.
And then he called me and asked me to come in as a, you know, like to replace someone who was leaving Caucasian Chalk Circle, which was in Mask. We used to call it Slaving and Gonav. at the Public. And in the middle of that rehearsal, one day he asked me to come over to Susan Birkenhead's house and to read a couple scenes. And all I was given was a couple of scenes, and they were scenes that read like, ba-dum-bum, ba-dum-bum, ba-dum-bum. You know, you can read the comedy on a thing. So I went in, I read the scenes, and I got the ba-dum-bums. And we were closing that weekend, and I was like a Saturday, and like, well, we'd like you to go to L.A. and do this new play, Jelly Slash Jam, at the Taper. Cool. Like, I'm back in with George C. Wolfe, who is now the George C. Wolfe. And so I didn't read the script until I was on the plane going to L.A., and I was with it. I had a nursing baby with me. And I arrived there, and I know nothing about this, and what I arrived to was a group of people who had been working on the show for several years.
Oh.
And yeah. The girl who had been playing this role in those workshops was now in the chorus.
Oh.
So this is the room I walk into.
And, that's a hard one.
Right. And also, in the course of reading the play, I realized that this was going to be my first opportunity not to play an ingenue. And so there was the challenge of that. But I was in a cold room. And so not only was I in a cold room, but I was also wanting to do something I'd never done before. So I kind of just didn't do anything in rehearsals, and I'd go home and I'd work it all out. But I was afraid to try anything in rehearsals because I could see everybody looking at me like, why did they hire her? You know, she's awful.
So there's a lot of criticism in the air.
You could feel the energy. There was just a lot of judgment. And I was just like, if I start this and I get one note on it, I just won't have the confidence to commit to what I've dreamed of. And I was like, can I make it to the first run through? If I can make it to the first run through. The night before the first run through, Mary Bond Davis was having a cabaret on Sunset Boulevard. And George and I's cars arrived at the same time. He didn't tell me this till 10 years later, but he had already decided he was going to fire me the next day.
Oh, my gosh.
But our cars arriving at the same time, he felt, he's very spiritual. So he felt like the car arrival at the same time was a sign he should let me get through the first run through. Hmm. And so I, you know, did that first run through and brought in everything I had been dreaming. And it was like, you would have thought that would have been a wonderful thing. It was like the shit hit the fan. It was like people who had discounted me and dismissed me were pissed that I was now going to be a force to be reckoned with. And it ruined all their plans. Yeah. And so, yeah.
But I love happy endings to that story. Because how do you get fired 4 or 5 times in one show? I don't know how. I mean, that is just like, that's a record. That's a world's record.
Yeah.
I feel like I have a saying that people don't go into theater because they don't like drama. So, like, you have big personalities, and if you can get like 40% on a stage, you're doing good.
Yeah. There was big personalities, and you know, some of the things that I went through on that one, I don't know if they still. I mean, they probably do still happen today. But I remember. Obababatunde did it in L.A., and Gregory Hines was doing it on Broadway, and his wife was producing. So everybody was walking around whispering, ooh, I heard you and Greg are going to do the Kama Sutra on stage. And it was getting me very nervous, and I asked one of the men who was an old friend of mine if he would be sure to be in the room with me, because I was just nervous about doing this bedroom scene with him. And we get to that scene, and there's the stage management team. Everybody's men. I'm the only woman in the room. My friend who I'd asked to be in the room wasn't in the room. Mm-hmm. And we're in this room, and then the rumor was also that I was not Gregory's choice. He wanted someone else. Mm-hmm. So it was just a lot of awkwardness to go into this scene. And I remember that I disassociated. It was the first time I understood what disassociation was. They had brought a 4-poster bed set piece in the room. And I remember Greg and George having this conversation, and I remember leaving my body, and I was like at the top of the 4-poster bed watching myself laughing. I was in horror, and Greg was like, okay, so this is the point where I'm a fucker in the ass, and here's where she's going to be sucking my dick, and I'm just like, ha, waiting to get to the break, whereupon I went and I called my manager and I said, I'm not doing the show. Just let me out of the show. And they put me on a film with a producer. I'm like, but we need it to be hot. We got to raise $5 million. And I was like, I can't do it. And so I got to be the bad cop. And it became that the reason Greg couldn't have what he wanted was because I wouldn't do it. And so literally Greg did not speak to me in public for the entire time we did that show. And it was this really clean demarcation, because on stage, masterful to work with. I mean, the play, the chemistry, spectacular. As soon as we left that stage, I did not exist.
Wow.
Wow. Well, I have actually, I won't go into it at this point in time, but I've actually experienced that. I know what you're talking about. I do have a reference for that, mm-hmm. but that, you, oh my God. But I'm,
you
know.
Did you and George ever, like, talk about what happened?
Nope.
Wow.
Not even to this day.
Wow.
Really?
Never.
And you would never bring it up?
It's, you know, it's so far in the past now, and I survived it, and, you know, it's like one of those, like, I earned my stripe stories.
But you, yeah. also,
you know what I mean? So it's, yeah. like, I survived it. But I got a Tony Award.
And now what you, yeah, it's, but, you know, but you use all of that so well in your work now. I mean, you work with, you volunteer, is that right?
I was a rape crisis counselor back in the early 80s, and I just... Right now, I'm in the midst of, I have a show that opened last night called Truth and Reconciliation of Women, which was my, it was the most exciting thing. Like, it was as good as winning a Tony. I didn't want to go to sleep after last night because I dreamed this up and I asked a lot of playwrights and songwriters to write plays by and about women and the way women oppress one another, and then for them to play God and model how that would be healed. So I have over 20 plays, and we're doing like 7 of them at the Tank with songs. Amanda Green and Shayna Talbot wrote this crazy song that ends the evening. And yeah, so
well,
I'm interested in women empowering each other. And
last night, yeah. Is it going to, are we going to?
Yeah, tonight again, I'm like, I can't wait. It's all this weekend.
Oh my God, congratulations.
Yeah, so that is my passion. Yeah. I host women's circles, and I'm interested in rebuilding the sacred feminine power that has been sublimated and lost. And so I do a lot of work around the world about women's power.
All these other, Michael John Lacusa.
Yes.
Is another spiritual person.
Is he?
He has. Do you know him?
Mm-mm.
I did. sorry about
no.
that.
No.
I know. I was afraid I was going to be the one that had.
Both of us were like, okay, Michael John Lacusa.
But you did the Wild Party with another great company, and Michael John Lacusa. That score, I just think he's
a genius.
It's a jazz opera. I mean, it's just great. But he has, and I did in London, but short-lived, and you know, but it was kind of experimental for this theater. But he came over, and we had lunch, and I don't think I'm speaking out of school, but he sees people.
Mm-hmm.
He sees image. He sees
like spirits.
Yeah. He sees the your
aura.
Aura. He can see auras. But other things come to him. And I said, that's fantastic. He said, I don't, you know, bring it out a lot because it scares people.
Yeah.
It just, you know, they don't. Mm-hmm. But he. But I had a wonderful session with him because he saw my grandmother.
Wow.
And he didn't say it was your grandmother, but I knew it was, you know. Mm. But he's a very special person.
Yeah, I love Michael John Lacusa's
music. And he teaches.
Music. I've never taught with him, but
teaching at NYU now?
I teach at NYU, and I teach at National Musical Theater Institute, and I love what you were saying about how you like to write a story, because that's what I really teach all my students, is that when you come in and do the song, tell us a story. I mean, we know you got a voice. You got the audition.
Right.
But where are you? Who are you talking to? What do you want? And as we're tracking the song, are you getting it? Are you failing? We want to see the journey of the character through the song. That's what we're going to see. And so that's what I teach in my music performance classes.
That's great. Because I find sometimes, especially with younger singers with great voices, sort of what's out there on The Voice and America's Got Talent, things like that, is just have this incredible voice, which of course is essential and great, but there's just an art to telling a story in a song.
Mm-hmm. And I'd rather see a good storyteller than a great voice anytime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course you can have both, but someone has to tell you to have both.
Right.
And not
and
just
also,
sort of like,
even if sometimes they understand it in theory, the everything is very, and maybe it's our culture, everything is like result oriented. So when you have a wonderful, I used to teach and I try to teach more, but you have an opportunity to work with younger people, younger artists, and help them not forget to discover along the way, mm-hmm. and not go, you know, take that journey in a mm-hmm. song in a real experienced way and not go for the result of it.
There's, yeah.
And I think, what do you think? Is the demand out there in our professional theater that you have to go in and be that, you know?
I feel like a lot with my students, I teach third year advanced scene study. I think that there's so much about school that still is about getting things right. And so what I found by the time they get to me, they've forgotten the joy of why they went into it. And so what I try to do in the class is I'm like, no, just bring in what excites you. And it takes them almost a month to realize that I honestly mean that. That I'm not looking, there's no right way. Like, I don't believe there's a right way. There's just your way. And you know it's your way because you're excited to get in the room and play with us. And then it's like, you'll show me that way. And I'll be like, okay, now show me another way. Like, what other way might you excited? And so that's how I work with my students. I really try to encourage them to keep finding what about this work is going to sustain you in a career. Because if it's not enjoyable, you're going to leave the business. There's too many other things that aren't the work that will give you a reason to walk away from the work. But if you just can't wait to get out there, that will sustain you in this business.
It's too hard.
It's too hard.
You have to really love it, right?
Yeah, you gotta love
it. And also, like, Broadway, I tell students, like, Broadway can't be your goal. Yeah. You have to love doing it and be happy doing it wherever, because so many people get to Broadway and then they're miserable because they thought this was going to make them happy and fill some brokenness that will only be healed, you know, on their own.
And I always laugh at people. I'm like, most of these theaters are kind of old and run down. The regionals are really nice.
And 8 a week. Let's not forget 8 shows a week.
Yeah.
I'm kind of enjoying the concert life at this moment.
Yes.
3 shows and then take a break.
Yes.
And what, you wrote a book.
I did.
Called Get Over Yourself. Is that for, is that a teaching
great
tool?
Is that
for kids or for all of us?
It's for adults. Like I said, I don't know what I do, but I feel like our bodies are our laboratory and that we can, you know, we can ask our bodies and it'll tell us what is going to work for us. So it's a kind of a manual about the ways in which we get in our own way and figuring out how to get out of our way. And a lot of it is about, like, what's your word medicine? What are the things you're saying to yourself and what is that bringing into
Did
your
world? Did you say
world?
Word medicine?
Your word medicine.
I love that.
Yeah, I know. That's a great thought. Yeah.
You know, I got to go to work versus I get to go to work.
Right.
You know, that bringing,
like,
that energy of gratitude.
An affirmative way about what you do. It's huge.
Speaking,
you know,
in affirmative,
I've right, I come up against this all the time with students, but also especially dancers, young dancers, because to do what they do, you have to have a lot of criticism. You're always reaching for something that's not possible. So to keep yourself going, you have to, you know, nothing's good enough. And if you grow up or have that in your, you know, home life at all, there's so much criticism that it stops someone from, you know, I don't know, it reflects everywhere.
I had a student last week who, I don't know how to explain it, but it's that clairvoyant thing. I just can energetically
you
feel
intuit
people.
Something
I
about
intuit
that,
things
yeah.
about people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she just was so interesting, and I was like, you were just really, you like to be in control. And she could do everything well. She could, you know, bop mop to the sky, like, she was funny, but it was controlled. And I was saying, I need you to figure out how to surprise yourself. And I really understood that, because when I do clown work, the funny in the clown is the moment when the clown doesn't know. It's that moment of what's next, that's the funny. And my control freak had learned to make that adjustment so fast that you never got to see that in me, which meant I couldn't be funny because I wasn't allowing myself to be in the moment where I didn't
know. Where you're
know.
At a loss.
Exactly. And that's
which is why you go see a clown.
Exactly. And so I had to work to let this defense that saved my life go in order to progress in my clown work.
So
you know?
It's a little love you toss in there.
Yeah.
A little acceptance.
It's such a vulnerable and intimate business that you really want to bring positivity into the room, and you want to be with people who bring positivity in the room, and there's so many little ways that you don't. Like, certainly when you're around a writer's table, like, remember how I said I like to solve the problems? So sometimes I approach an idea or pitch like it's a problem. So I'm going to say, well, what if we did this in Act 2? And my first brain reaction is, okay, what's that going to mess up about Act 1, and how am I going to change this? And that, and what I realized about myself very late in life was that that was the energy I then put to the person who had just pitched that to me. Mm. That I would be like, okay, well, what's going to be wrong with that? And what's going to be, you know, there's... So I was just saying no,
yeah.
Basically. But when Or what you should say is, yes, what a good idea. Thank you for pitching it. Thank you for being comfortable for pitching it. Now let's figure it out together.
Now, so, I want to riff on that.
Please.
Because I also, at this point in my life, have given myself the name I Am Coyote Medicine. And I feel like I have a thing that you talk about that I do the same thing. I see the big picture. So I'm in the room. I love this collaboration. And everybody puts everything together. And I can see all the holes. So, like, for me, I always want to see my understudy. Because if I think if they're really good, I've got tunnel vision creating it. They see everything I'm doing. They can steal all that. But they see what I don't see because I'm in the tunnel. So then I go see them. I got my stuff. I got their stuff. One of the show-stopping moments I had in Play On came from seeing my understudy. She did something. I went up to her. I said, that was fabulous. I'm stealing it. Watch what I do with it tonight. It became a stop the show moment. Wow. So I feel like this thing you're talking about is the same thing I'm talking about. Once I see all the ideas everybody does, I see the holes. And so I feel like that is a very good energy to bring. It's the turtle energy. It's the coyote energy that's just like adding to it. For me, like when someone goes, that's really good, I go, praise sandwich, you're about to give me a criticism. So like you're saying, that's what you do? Like
that's
for me, I'm like, no.
And now comes yeah. the
no, I'd rather, I like the direct.
I don't know. I feel like the first, when someone brings something out of themselves and offers it up as a writer, I just smacked my microphone. When someone brings something out and offers it up in the room, that's a really vulnerable moment. And they deserve a little respect for even having the courage to do that. And I didn't mean to not give them respect. Actually, I respect somebody when I start picking apart their idea because I'm actually engaging with them.
Yes, absolutely.
But it doesn't feel that way to the other person. And guess what? We're in a business of collaboration. Yeah. And you should care about the other person's feelings. Right. And you should treat them with dignity and respect.
It's part of it. It's hard not to be reactive sometimes.
Very
I have
hard.
To watch myself
yes.
all the time. And also what I think you're talking about is, it's right, it's like the one arm's length. When you're in it, I believe, for me, I need a director because I can't, at a certain point in time, I can't tell. But when you're able to stand back in that situation and see your understudy, it's like being able to be objective in spite of yourself, you know?
So do you purposefully call out to see your understudy?
Sometimes. I also have been an understudy, so I want them to get to go on. Like, it's so miserable
and
to be an understudy.
And do you do this before opening so then you can have this moment?
Of course.
Wow.
I want to see.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So fascinating.
I'd rather watch someone else than me do it. That's my whole thing. So I like
the feeling when I feel that way. I don't like the feeling when I leave and go, oh, God, I need to do that because I could do that so much better than that. It's got to happen. I prefer that feeling when I'm like, they were so good.
Inspiring. You got inspired.
I like to be inspired by people.
So this is something, a quote that you said.
Okay.
Tell me if I got this right, because I believe this, too, that theater is the greatest power. From a stage, you can integrate in the theater in a way that doesn't exist in the world. You can integrate in terms of you can be the community reflecting. But explain that a little bit.
Quote is actually from my Truth and Reconciliation plays. I'm really fascinated by neuroscience and the fact that they know that the brain does not show us the world as it is. It shows us a prediction of the world based on the files that we have. And the only way to change the brain, which is the amygdala, which is where all our emotions are, is through an experience. Mm-hmm. Like, the amygdala does not shift except in response to an experience. And so in creating these plays, I feel like when you're in the theater, it's the only form of entertainment where you're actually having an experience with people. So putting people of different cultures, different generations together, I feel like the audience has an experience of something that then becomes a file in their mind. So when they get in a situation, they actually have a new file and a new prediction of how that might go. So that's what I'm trying to do with the Truth
it's
and Reconciliation.
It's fantastic. Place. It's great. And it changes people's lives.
I hope so.
Very quickly.
I hope so.
You have an experience.
You have an experience. Yeah.
If you put it out there, it can be real. right?
Yeah.
So
well,
if you put your ideal out there. I think about it with Sesame Street.
Oh, I love Sesame Street.
Well, you know, if you put lessons of, like, kindness and stuff like that out there, that becomes part of the culture. And people, I don't know, it just gets into your brain, as you said. It gives you a file, and you say, if I'm in this situation, maybe I should behave a little more like Grover and a little less like a complete jerk.
Yeah. Right. So, like, all of these plays we have, they're women in different situations, and in each one, they figure out a way to work it out, you know? And so I feel like we're modeling that for an audience, that they might have a situation in their life that they couldn't see a path to a working it out, and they do in this. And that's so different than most theaters. We really like to put the problem, because it's exciting. We love to play the problem. And these plays have the problems, but I was really interested in the solutions as well. Yeah. That's what I asked my writers for.
Fantastic. Well, that matches up with you said something else. I have the worst writing. For my third act, or for the rest of my life, I think you said, I speak my truth and do whatever I can as an artist for the evolution of social justice.
Mm. I said that?
Yes. It's beautiful.
Big words there, Tony. Yeah.
I think that, you know, with or without me, the whole universe is evolving towards higher levels of good. And so I want to, as much as possible, hold that as a truth, so that's my contribution, that I'm holding the sacred space and the energy for everything to be good and evolving towards higher and higher levels of completion.
Yeah.
That's, you know, and sometimes that's telling someone that something doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because dissatisfaction is the seed of evolution. When we're dissatisfied with something, we want something better. And so
to me, it's like you keep your integrity. Whatever the cost might be there, but you make strides.
Because we only have ourselves, and the only thing we can fix is ourselves. So that's the thing I try to tell my students. Like Bill Esper said, if you go into an audition and you did that thing that turned you on and they didn't hire you, be grateful, because they didn't appreciate it and they were going to make you miserable trying to get you to do something else.
That's a great way to look at it.
Good way to look at it.
Because we don't know why we get hired sometimes or why we don't get it, you know.
Yeah.
So can I jump over? Thank you for. I mean that is you. One of my questions. I had all these questions, but I don't need them, obviously. What interests me, and I think I hope you know other people listening or watching would, how we do what we do. What sparked the attraction. I mean, some people are 3 years old when they start working professionally. Really?
Well, my mom put me into commercials, but then she wanted me to have a normal childhood, so I stopped.
Yeah, for 4 years.
And then I saw Annie, and I begged her to let me do it again. And so, I've been doing it since
but
then.
But that was, how did you say to yourself, I want to be an actress? Where did that come from?
I just knew. When I saw Annie, I just knew.
Oh, but when you were three?
No, my mom did that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was just to get money for college.
Oh, okay.
So nine-year-old me was when I decided this was what I wanted to do and didn't want to do anything else.
Right. After Annie.
And, you know,
I just worked with Annie this past weekend. Yeah.
Which one?
Andrea McCarter.
Oh. Yeah. Well. Listen to her
so
a lot growing up.
Right. And then.
And you know, I feel like we probably all the times where we've been like, that's it. I'm done. I'm going to go be a social worker.
Yeah. And, definitely.
But then I think it's important to constantly surrender, because then that's when it comes back to you and you're not like this desperate person. You're like, okay, well, I guess I'm meant to do this for a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I used to quit every year in my mind. I would honestly say to myself, and I was here alone trying to prove myself to my parents because I, you know, ran away and I had to show them that I could take care of myself and they weren't going to be there. They didn't want me to be doing this.
Wow.
But I went, I have no personality for this business. And every year it was so hard. And I thought I have to find something else to do, but nothing else mattered as much. I mean, I went to therapy and then I was fine. Not really. So I'm going to talk a little bit as we're winding down. Oh my gosh, I'm so stimulated by this talk. I want to go out and do wonderful things. What is your podcast about? You're doing all the plays again tonight. Are we going to be able to see it?
Come tonight. Come tonight. We're definitely videoing these, and hopefully they'll broadcast somewhere or stream somewhere, because I said I've got 20 some plays, and I probably ask you to write something for me.
Please do.
I will.
I love to write.
Oh, yeah. I would love to have a piece of work by you. I love Legally Blonde so much. I love that movie.
Thank you.
And the musical was such a beautiful execution of that. You know, so hard to take things and move them to different genres, but I thought that you did that so expertly.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, but you asked me a question. I don't remember what the... my podcast.
Yeah.
You know, I have opinions about things. I have opinions, and people tend to tell me things they've never said before. So last year I did like 46 Me Too interviews, and, you know, learned a lot of things about what's possible, what is technologically possible. And so I'll be interviewing people and talking about things in the theater that aren't so much the press of the theater and the selling of shows, but really intimately talking about what it's like as an artist to work in this business and, you know...
Negotiate through
tough
things?
People just tell me things that they just don't say. So I'm often that voice in the room that's speaking people's truth that they don't say. So I hope in this interview people will be comfortable enough to speak some of those truths and feel safe. This is a terrible story, but it's kind of funny. My mother suffered from mental illness all her life. Mm. And this is just to exhibit how people talk when they're with me. And one time I went home to visit her, and she was talking about the evil entity in the house. And all I knew was I was going to enter into that with her, whatever that was. And I was like, well, if the evil entity is in the house, maybe it would be good if you got out of the house and you could build some strength to manage the evil entity. And so I suggested that we find some residential in-treatment centers and that she could check herself in and check herself out. And that didn't really work for her. But finally, I was able to convince her to go meet someone. And so we did, and I asked to sit in on the intake interview. And so she felt so comfortable in the intake interview with me that when she excused herself to go to the bathroom, the doctor's like, oh, she won't be leaving. So she comes back, and she's like, I don't like this place. The doors are locked. I have to go. At which point, it's not in my hands anymore. And so they kept my mother there, and she really believed that I had had her committed, which I hadn't had anything to do with it. So in order to keep someone, they have to be interviewed by two doctors. And of course, when the next doctor came in, she knew how to say exactly what was necessary to get out. But just to say that people tend to just be really open when they're with me, and sometimes it gets them committed.
Oh my gosh. Now I'm having second thoughts about this whole life.
But I would go on that show. I would talk to you because you make me very comfortable. I relate to it. Maybe that's a problem.
Well, come on my
I have.
Show.
I
don't when are you know. Coming on my show?
But now, I mean, so you love writing.
I love writing.
You're so good. Was there any moment of inspiration that changed you, or a mentor that, or you had an inclination? Were you young?
I always was writing. I always was reading, and I always was writing. But
as a
kid, yeah, I would write little stories for my classmates,
really,
and things like that. Yeah, I cast everybody in a long-running soap opera that I kept in a spiral notebook, and people would come and be like, "What are we doing this week? What's happening this week?" So I just enjoyed, doing it.
Did you ever? I mean, while you're doing it, and I mean, which is fabulous. It would just stay in the back of your mind that you just would keep doing it, or did you have a projection of what you?
I didn't
at a certain point in time when, as you were growing up, you know.
I didn't ever think that I would be a professional writer. You sort of hoped, but I didn't know how that happened. And it was actually Larry, my husband Larry O'Keefe, who when I was working in banking and. He was out in Los Angeles, and he's like, are you going to do this? And I said, I don't know. You know, I'm making good money. I'm here with my family. You're out in L.A. He's like, you know everybody out here, and they're all just trying. And it's like, maybe you should try.
Because he was already doing it.
Yeah, he was already doing it. And the fact that he had the confidence in me to say, like, come out. We'll figure it out.
and I bet something will happen for you. And I didn't actually get a job writing when I got out there. I got a job working for an agency because I didn't know how entertainment worked. And I thought, I still had a very school mindset, which I have in general, which is figure out what the assignment is and then go and do the assignment. And so I was like, okay, I have to figure out how the entertainment industry works, first of all, that statement.
Well, that's
right. And then,
that's a great way to do it. That's very clever.
Right. So I was, so I said, how do you learn? And they're like, oh, go work for an agency. So I worked for the charming psychopaths at that agency for some time and realized nobody really does know how this industry works.
William Goldman's my favorite book, Nobody Knows Anything. Or the, is that the name of it?
Is that what
no, that's
called?
A byline.
Adventures in the Screen Trade.
The screen, yes.
Adventures
and that my and I underlined every time he said that, which was a couple times. Nobody knows anything, and I thought that's you can apply that to just about
to just
everything.
About anything, yeah. So, but the good news about nobody knowing anything is that if you make your own path with some sense, if you literally say, "Everybody, follow me." People will generally do it if you just project enough confidence. Now, usually that's a terrible thing.
It's a cult leader.
Yeah. But sometimes to say, we're going to go this way because it's going to be a good way to go, and people come with you, and
this reminds me of a very funny story I have to tell you. We're probably keeping the waiters up, but I have that. It's a survival thing with me when I came here so young. That I had to act, I felt, it just fell into it, like I knew what I was doing all the time, so that I would walk with purpose, so that people, you know, some guy, you know, homeless man wouldn't kind of creep around and say, what do you want to sit down for a minute? I had to walk with purpose, never make eye contact, and it just, I fell into this instinctually. And so I didn't even know I had it as much as I did, but my sister and I went on a vacation in Saint Martinique, I think, and in this beautiful, you know, place, a villa, and there's a pool, and we're out when, and it's a bonding, a sister bonding, and because I left home, and we're having a great time, and she's my little sister, 5 years younger, and she said, and she's going to dive in with the two of us at the pool at night after dinner. It was just lovely. And she goes, is this the deep end? And I said, sure. And she dove in, and it wasn't the deep end.
Oh, my God.
I know. And came up, like, very quickly. And I'm sitting there in shock, horror. And she said, you said it was the deep end. Luckily, she was talking. And I said, you're listening to me? And I went, that's when I started waking up a little bit and going, I have to, like, really pay attention. When going to Paris for the first time, I would get out of the car, never been there before, and I started walking. Like, I knew where I was going. And my friend said, Donna, we're going this way. Where are you going? I went, oh, I thought it was this way. I mean, it's something that I don't do anymore. But anyway, it protected
you. It protected you for a long time.
Yeah. Just move with purpose, regardless of where you're going.
That's right.
I wanted to jump on your writing story because I did that as a kid. I used to write when I was like, I wrote my first novel when I was like 6, and I kept writing. And I went to a small school of like 35 kids that we all went from first grade to 8th together. And so by the time we got to 4th grade, I would be handing out the people section, so they find out it was a story about when we grew up. We were going to go on this reunion, and it was kind of like The Last of Sheila, but everybody was getting raped and murdered and stuff like that, because I love horror. And my fourth grade teacher saw somebody with it, and she collected all of the pieces, and it was something I'd hunt and pecked on a typewriter, so there was only one copy in existence. And she stood up in front of the class, and she ripped it to shreds and threw it in one of those big gray garbage cans. And I then went home and destroyed all my paintings, all my art. I destroyed everything that I had done creatively, and it, you know, it's taken a lifetime to get back to trusting, my writing.
That's, again, affirmation.
Yeah.
It's such a small thing to put out there, but it has such a big impact.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My husband saying, I think you can make it. Yeah. What did that cost him? 2 seconds of his time, and it changed my life.
Yeah.
It really...
Support.
And that's what I meant about when someone throws an idea out, trying not to automatically look at them and be like, well, what's the problem with your idea? To be like, okay... Even if you think it's like the worst idea ever, and be like, how is it not the worst idea ever?
Yeah.
Because it might not be.
Right.
And certainly it will mean a lot to that person if you engage.
Yeah.
I just feel like if a small effort yields a big reward,
yes.
make it.
And I want to thank you all for being here. And I'm going to get this to go because I couldn't even get fascinated.
It's too much talking.
So we don't have the champagne, but I wanted...
The champagne?
We have water, but it's we're not superstitious, are we? I just want to do a toast and say thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Here's to us, onward and upward.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. Cheers.
Look in the eyes.
Look in the eyes.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.